Okay, hello and welcome to another episode of The Deprogram. With us today, we've got Brendan James, one half of the Blowback podcast, which is super exciting for me because Blowback is hands down my favorite podcast after The Deprogram, of course. If you guys have been living under a rock, Blowback just released season 3 of their show. This one is on the Korean War. So we figured it'd be a good opportunity to both introduce some new people to a great show and also to learn a bit about the Korean War. So Brendan, thank you for coming on.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So before we really start talking about the Korean War and stuff like that, could you just give our audience a little bit of a TLDR? Who are you and what made you want to start Blowback?
Well, I guess without being redundant, I am the host of Blowback. That's my main job these days. But I used to be a full-time journalist for several years. I wrote for places like Newsweek and The Guardian and Vice and stuff like that. And what made me want to start Blowback, I had previously been, you know, the producer of another podcast, Chapo Trap House, which listeners may also be aware of. I founded that with them and I was the producer for several years. But then I kind of wanted to do something new. And so my current co-host, Noah, actually proposed at dinner. This sounds very romantic. At dinner one night, he proposed, not to me, but proposed an idea that we do a show about Iraq. And I was looking, you know, for something to do. And at first, I wasn't sure if it was so necessary to do that because it felt like a settled issue. But as I began to see, you know, in that it was acknowledged as a giant crime and a disaster, yeah, and all of that. But what made us follow through was that I started to see, or at least why I wanted to follow through and change my mind, was that I started to see the rehabilitation of the Bush administration in the Trump years. And I thought that maybe things are moving that fast. And there's also, you know, without showing my aging too much, it did feel like there were younger people who, you know, just didn't live through it, that are, yeah, you know, out there, who maybe would be up for hearing that story. And so that's why we started the show. And then we just were very pleasantly surprised at how lovely a reception we got and how many people listened to that first season. So we started doing more.
When I first listened to season one, I was, you know, I was blown away. I was like, wow, these people actually put effort into a podcast. And it really shows. Like, it's a super polished thing.
Thank you.
Side note, how did you land H. John Benjamin for that?
You know, I met him at a party several years ago.
What a life you lead, man.
he was a Chapo fan, and he was just at a party. I think might have been at some bar, and I bumped into him, but that was years ago, and I don't know if he even remembers that. But Sam Sater, who runs the Majority Report, I think it's called, I had been interviewed by him a couple times, and Sam was nice enough to introduce us more formally, because I just I really wanted John Benjamin to play Saddam Hussein. I can't explain why. And so I wrote that sketch as a way to sort of, you know, give people an opening taste of what the show's atmosphere would be, trying to balance these different tones. And I thought, you know, who could play Saddam? And I don't know why, it was crystal clear in my head it was H. John Benjamin. And so luckily Sam knows him quite well. I think Sam did a voice for Home Movies, which is a show that John was on years ago. And I heard him as Coach McGurk. I just heard Saddam yelling like Coach McGurk did in that show at George Bush, who was played very very deftly by James Adomian, who I had also worked with in the past as well, who's a great comedian and impressionist. So John was very, very kind to jump in and do that little cameo.
That's super cool. Yeah, I don't think that's what people would expect when opening Spotify and listening to a podcast about the Iraq War. But yeah, definitely a lot of fun. So let's talk a little bit more about the production value of the show, because it really does stand out from the rest of the crop of podcasts you can find. So
thank you.
How did you create such a polished podcast? Like, why did you decide that was the route you wanted to take? Like, with the music and the interviews, it's all such a polished production. What was your process like?
The absolute opposite of what we do.
I used to come from my old show was a talk show. It was very informal, and in a way, I think that may be the beginning of an answer to the question. It's funny because I actually don't hear it as polished, because I know where the bodies are buried.
Having
put it together, but you know, because as I'm sure you guys can relate to, even though you're being a little self-deprecating, when you make something you're proud of, you know, you even if you feel it's good, you know that it could be tighter, it could always be better. And so I take your point, though. People have pointed out, you know, it's definitely we're going for somewhere between the sort of hyper polished style of, say, you know, like an NPR piece or something like that, where it's, or like a BBC, you know, very traditional, supposedly authoritative sounding thing. We're balancing between that and the more chaotic, improvisational sound you can hear on a lot of podcasts, maybe most podcasts. But coming from my old show and being a talk show, I thought it would be interesting, just as a new type of style, to try to be more narrative and focused on really crafting a story, a compelling story. And we found our way slowly toward that, in fact, because I find that season one is a little rougher, which is fine because it's season one. Mm-hmm. But it is a little bit more. Noah, when we started recording it, we would set up two mics and be in a room and just go on outlines. So there's very little that was actually written. And I'd like to think that if you listen to the next two seasons, you can hear that we wrote all this stuff down, and then we're just narrating it. And we're not really so much going for the banter or the off the cuff approach. And so that took a little while to develop, but it felt like we hit the right formula when we started to, when especially I produce and edit it, you know, when I started to arrange things that way. And then the music is really just a sort of me hijacking the project, because I wanted to, years and years ago, before I was a writer, I wanted to be a musician. I was going to go to school for classical composition, and I took a sort of sharp turn and didn't do that. But I sort of have been eager to try and get back into composing stuff ever since. And so I thought it would gel with the style of the show if I did a little atmosphere. And I really didn't do all that much in the first season, but people even liked a bit of that. So I thought I should take it, you know, more seriously for seasons two and three, maybe too seriously. But it's a pleasure to do the music as well. And there will be I have to plug now the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, do it.
The soundtrack for season three will be coming out within, I mean, I'm sure by the time people hear this, if they're fans, they'll have listened to a bit of the show. But the soundtrack will be coming out on August 1st. So
the music you do is really fantastic. I mean, like Jupiter Missiles, for example, I always get goosebumps listening to that one. That's really, really well done. So
if people subscribe to season three, there is a demo version of Jupiter Missiles that's a little bit different that you can hear.
I'm going to have to subscribe.
As a goodie. Yeah, I should say. Yeah, that's one of the things we want to give our subscribers, you know, a bunch of goodies. And one of them is a kind of, you know, B-sides or demo album of stuff that, you know, either isn't going to be on the main releases of the music, or is from older seasons and never got a release. So yeah, check that out if you do enjoy the music.
Absolutely. Yeah, that sounds like a really cool perk. And yeah, I think you guys did strike a really good balance between like the super polished production and also being accessible and feeling modern and not, you know, old fashioned and stale old media style stuff. So
great.
definitely a great show.
Thank you.
So I guess let's pivot a little bit towards the content of season three. Many of our listeners will probably know very little about the Korean War. It's called the Forgotten War for a reason. So could you give us a quick TLDR of the war? I know that's asking a lot.
It's only forgotten to Americans. The Koreans remember it very well.
Yes.
Yeah, very true. And I'm sure that'll be part of the answer, because it is intentional, right?
Yes. I think that we were, you know, I should have maybe said this in the first episode. So I'll just, you know, edit our whole conversation into the first episode after we are done recording, because I'm thinking of things I didn't even remember to say. But, you know, our first season, we talked about how the Iraq War was, I think in Noah's words, you know, shoved down the memory hole, which was a big reason why we were, as I kind of already alluded to, why we chose to tell a story about it. But the Korean War, interestingly, is sort of the official history has beaten us to the punch on that and called it. It's very in vogue for the past several years, I would say maybe the past 10 or 20 years, to refer to it as the Forgotten War. So it's kind of getting ahead of our podcast, annoyingly, where we were supposed to say that. But then you look a little closer, and I don't want to sound too persnickety, but I think that even calling it the Forgotten War, which is not the worst way to try and introduce the concept to people, is sort of, because it's now on book jackets and in articles and think pieces, it is a way to sort of tip the hat and then move on and say, that's Forgotten War. It's really interesting if you ever, want to go a little deeper. There's probably a lot going on there, but it's forgotten. And, so let's remember the troops and let's remember blah, 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 and move on.
Yeah.
And it's sort of maybe yet another way in which we try to look away from what really happened, because there are other words you could use to describe it without, I think, pushing the envelope all that much. I mean, it was incredibly destructive. It was, in the words of, I mean, we asked the preeminent historian of the Korean War in the English language, Bruce Cummings, we asked him, do you think this was a genocide? And he answered yes.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit more spicy than just it being a forgotten war. Something else is going on here. And so I guess to answer your question, it's called the Forgotten War, but that doesn't really do it justice. And we wanted to, in our third season, we were already kind of going back in time each season. We started in the 2000s with Iraq, and then our second season was about the Cuba crisis in the 60s. And then now we're in the late 40s and early 50s. And it felt right to go to Korea because, maybe as we'll discuss further, it was just on its face, not only an undercovered element of American foreign policy at the dawn of the Cold War, but it also, each time we turned the clock back, the previous two seasons sort of had a greater context to them as well, because we're seeing further and further and in more detail how the national security state is being set up and how the Cold War is being crafted and defined as a ideological fixture in American life. Mm. And that happens in the Korean War.
Yeah, I'm the eldest of six kids in my family, and wow, I did not learn a thing about the Korean War in school, and the same goes for my siblings. I asked them if their history books had anything about it, and I think at most one of them had one of those one-page insert things, like in a box,
sure,
which is crazy to me.
Yeah,
a little blurb, yeah, about this, like you said, rightly, a genocide. So For the listeners who aren't familiar, could you give us a little bit of a rundown of just how destructive this war was for the Korean people?
Sure. I think maybe even before that, I would say that the context, if people do learn about it in school, it's the sort of canned history is that the North invaded the South out of nowhere in 1950 on the orders of Joseph Stalin, because the North was a puppet state or puppet regime of the Soviet Union, and it wanted to take over the whole peninsula, or Stalin wanted to take over the whole Korean peninsula for reasons that aren't terribly clear in that telling. Mm-hmm. And the U.S., in the dawn of liberal sort of humanitarian intervention, was really forced to intervene and defend this vulnerable fledgling democracy in the South. And that's the Korean War. And then it ended with an armistice in 1953. Sometimes you get the fact that it didn't end the war, it just ended the military conflict of the past 3 years up until that moment. But that's sort of the official history,
right,
or the canned history. And it's one of those things where general reference points are true-ish, but the further you look into it and the closer you look, it becomes a bunch of nonsense. And so maybe we can get into the wider reinterpretation of the war as opposed to what I just laid out there. But as far as the destruction goes, it was actually quite shocking, I would say, while we were researching it. We were doing an interview the other day and someone said, is there anything that surprised you? And I really actually, going into it, I knew it was, horrible to say the least, but the level of destruction wrought specifically on North Korea, although we did bomb the South as well, was beyond what I had imagined. effectively the entire state of the DPRK was destroyed, was leveled. Urban areas were 40 to 90% destroyed, depending on, you know, which city. So at least half destroyed. We saturated them with napalm. It was called the Wonder Weapon at the time. It had been used, I think, near the end of World War II, but, you know, the Korean War, like many other things, was the chance to really test this stuff out in a singular way after that conflict had innovated, after World War II had innovated a lot of new weaponry. And it was actually, it's argued that the use of napalm in Korea was even more devastating than it was in, say, Vietnam, due to the geography and the sort of concentration of the cities in North Korea. That was an extra thing that was just not on the northerners' side when being attacked by this weapon, as opposed to Vietnam. It's very, you know, it's a very different climate and very different geography. And so I think it's tough to even know the full, you know, death toll, but it is somewhere between 2 to 3 million people died.
Jesus.
And that was disproportionately from the United States or UN forces killing civilians. And, you know, there's the military dead as well, which I don't think shouldn't be counted. But there was the reason that Bruce Cummings, one of the reasons he called it genocidal is because there was such a intentional and frequent targeting of civilians by the U.S. military. And this is just the air war, which I would argue is the most, by the numbers, destructive part of it. But of course, you had incredible dislocation and violence perpetrated on the ground as well. It's just that the stalemate was sort of reached by the end of 1951, or really by mid-1951. And so for the next 2 years, it was a stalemate on the ground, but it was an utter slaughter from the air. And we blew up dams, you know, was something that the air war included, which, you know, these dams would be pretty central to feeding people in North Korea, to producing food and energy and other things. The phrase that kept coming up among pilots or among those interviewing pilots was that eventually there were, quote unquote, no more targets.
Jesus.
And the North adjusted to that by beginning to build not just military installations underground, but really living underground. People started to live underground in order to avoid being, you know, obliterated above ground. And you wonder why they thought several decades later it might be good to have a deterrent of some kind against this thing happening.
Yeah, and this was, you know, coming hot on the heels of the United States developing and becoming the only country to this day to use against other human beings nuclear weapons.
That's right.
So to what extent does that willingness to use these shiny new toys contribute to the very prevalent rumblings you hear that the United States deployed chemical and maybe biological weapons in Korea? Because I know there's relationships with Japan and some of their more infamous units. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Just on the nuclear point, before getting to the allegations of germ warfare, the A-bomb was considered for Korea several times. It was definitely on the table that we might just nuke them. That was discussed at the highest levels from everyone from the moderates, quote unquote. You know, you think of the moderates, and again, I use that as a relative term, but it might be useful to think of. You had a section of the American government or ruling class that just wanted the war confined to Korea. And that, of course, is a bloodbath, no doubt. But they didn't want it to be a confrontation, a nuclear-tipped confrontation with, say, the Soviet Union and or China, which didn't have a nuke yet, but that was obviously a massive power that would have probably, you know, drawn in a full confrontation just a couple years after World War II. Truman, Dean Acheson, who was the Secretary of State, others like them, the sort of enlightened types, didn't want that. Then you have the hardliners, the cold warriors in the extreme, like General Douglas MacArthur, who was the supreme commander in the war and had immense prestige after World War II. And he wanted a showdown. He wanted and was, in fact, eventually fired and taken out of command because he was going over Truman's head and at times bombing the borders of the Soviet Union and China, and was driving up to past the Yalu River only a few months into the war, toward China, that is. And so the MacArthur types, and maybe you could think of Joe McCarthy at home and other politicians, they were the ones who wanted this to be final, not a little self-contained thing in Korea, but something that wiped out communism for good, which, of course, involves wiping out a lot of people.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, there was a tussle within the leadership over whether we should just nuke them. It never happened, obviously, but there were bombers that would have carried, in a different history, nuclear payloads that flew over North Korea, and the North Koreans didn't know whether they had real bombs inside or not. And they were, you have to imagine what it would have felt like seeing those things fly over your head and thinking, oh yeah, this is it. Mm. They're going to nuke us. So again, that doesn't, you don't forget that a couple years later or even decades later. Now, on as far as the allegations of germ warfare, the defeat of Japan in World War II, similar to the defeat of the Nazi regime, produced a post-war sort of exchange program between the defeated Axis powers and the, you know, ascendant United States. People may be familiar with things like Operation Paperclip, in which lots of Nazi scientists came to America and worked for America. Operation Gladio is an even more, I think, currently obscure part of our history, in which we worked with ex-fascists, or rather ex-Nazi or official fascists that stayed behind in Europe. They're called so-called stay behind missions to pull the strings in the background. But then with regard to Japan, you had the sort of Mengele department in the Japanese military was not solely this one unit, but most infamously Unit 731. Mm-hmm. And people may have heard of this before. It's the head of it was a man named Shiro Ishii. And he was, if you like, the, you know, Japanese Mengele. And these were this was a unit, as well as some other units, that experimented on human beings in pretty grotesque ways. It's quite, you know, chilling to read of the experiments, from everything from using live human guinea pigs, you know, testing diseases on them, testing just mutilating them, putting them out in the cold, seeing if they would, you know, how quickly they would die of frostbite, just really anything under the sun that you could do to a person to just see what would happen.
Yeah.
And so that's obviously quite grim. And this was an active, like, known germ warfare detachment, because again, they didn't just mutilate people or leave them out and experiment on them. They also tested diseases on them, and it was initially supposed to be to, like, study cures or you know, workshop vaccines or things like that. But it very quickly descended into just, you know, mad scientist stuff. And that was Unit 731. Unit 731, many elements of it are welcomed into the fold of the new U.S.-friendly Japan by MacArthur following the end of World War II. And people can listen to the show for the extensive detail. We have several episodes on it, in fact. But what is alleged, because it is not, as they say, there is no smoking gun yet. So, you know, as a decent journalist, I have to say it's you know, alleged or reported.
Right.
The North Koreans and the Chinese claim and have claimed since the war that it did in fact happen. But and in fact, there was a commission that was sent over there, made up of Western, quite prestigious Western scientists from the time, that did agree and said that there was evidence that it happened. Then there was sort of a back and forth for many decades between scientists and, of course, between the governments of these of the belligerents in the war that dispute different things. But there is certainly a trail to something going on. But the allegation, to get all that context out of the way, because there's no one disputes Unit 731 and the experiments that Japan did during the war, which was against, among others, American prisoners of war. Of course, Chinese as well. And so the idea is that 731 and its methods were incorporated into the American toolkit in the Korean War. And we've already talked about how things like napalm that were used and innovated near the end of World War II were used. Obviously, the nuke was a big button that was on standby, that was, again, the result of, you know, World War II innovations. And so is it that unlikely that biological warfare would have been in the cards as well? And what the Chinese and North Koreans allege is that things like smallpox were released upon certain towns that would not have had, if you like, a kind of geographical relationship of a natural epidemic spreading, that chicken feathers were the sort of vector by which, because they did pathogens and diseases can stick to chicken feathers really well. They float. They travel long distances. They look somewhat innocuous in an agricultural context. The chicken feathers were used by the U.S. using methods of Unit 731 in order to infect the population of North Korea during the war, because the U.S. was in retreat, and it was something that it thought, you know, let's wild out a little bit here and see if we can test out some stuff, given that we're getting our asses kicked right now. And, you know, I think that the example of Hiroshima a couple years before was definitely a lesson that the U.S. was not against deploying that kind of mass violence. And Hiroshima and Nagasaki were immensely more destructive than even, you know, the germ warfare that the Chinese and North Koreans allege. So it's not exactly as though they're inventing some kind of charge that pales in comparison to what was already known to have happened.
Yeah, you can't say they wouldn't do it, you know.
It's you know, there's, again, we try to be balanced about it in the show, but we obviously, more than most in America, we are giving that argument and that the evidence, if not the proof, yet. Because there's a lot that hasn't been declassified, frankly, and there's a lot that may never be declassified. As we discussed in season two, the Joint Chiefs destroyed, you know, decades worth of minutes of their meetings, you know, in the middle of the 60s. So so we truly may never know. At any rate, that's the allegation, and that's what we explore in the show at a certain point.
Man, I can't wait to listen. I'm going to listen as soon as this is over.
I just managed to get through the first season, and now I just started today. I started the first episode of season two, and my God, it slaps! Jesus Christ! Yeah.
Thank you very much.
So I can't wait to jump in.
Yeah, season two is frankly award worthy, I think.
Oh, thank you very much.
So moving on a little bit, everyone knows about the war in Vietnam. You know, all around the world, people know it. But Korea, is it just the United States that's not really aware of what happened in Korea, or is it also, you know, quote unquote, forgotten in other parts of the world? And we talked about this a little bit before, but what is the mechanism by which it's been, you know, forgotten in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, there's probably so many things that go into that, but I think that it is sheerly by comparison to the notoriety of the Vietnam War all over the world, with the exception of Korea and China, and I would argue maybe Japan as well. It is just, it's less infamous and sort of is thought of as maybe a prequel to Vietnam, or a sort of demo tape for what would happen in Vietnam, and therefore, you know, not its own conflict in its own right, if you like, when in fact it was just as deadly and just as significant. And I think that there's a lot of reasons. I mean, Vietnam, of course, politics were in a different place by the time it was happening. The 50s are, it's a bit of a cliche, but they were a little more buttoned up. There was not a kind of coming apart of the cultural consensus in America that happened during the Vietnam War that sort of broke through a lot of official button down reporting or even consuming of news about Vietnam. In Korea, it was all sort of, it wasn't necessarily popular. In fact, the war was deeply unpopular about a year in, but there just wasn't that same sort of wave of change that accompanied the Vietnam War that was happening. You know, the real explosion of confrontation over civil rights. Again, this is not to say these issues didn't exist, but the acknowledgement, the kind of wide awake feeling that people had suddenly under Johnson and Nixon, that had not arrived yet. And so I think there was just a less of a cultural footprint, which is how a lot of people remember these things. You know, MASH, the American, first it was a great film by Robert Altman, and then it was a great TV show. But MASH is set in the Korean War, and it was an immensely popular show, but it was, you know, widely acknowledged to be really a metaphor or a allegory for the Vietnam War that was happening while MASH was being made. So as I think I put it in the first episode, even the show, the really popular show about the Korean War, isn't really about the Korean War. And so it just keeps getting, it never really is looked at in the light for that reason. And I'm talking about culture, but of course there's other political reasons as well, that just things were, it was called a police action. you know, from the start, which was, again, this is an interesting point, too, because it was the beginning of the new liberal order in which we would, as America, we would supposedly consult the UN and go and intervene for the sake of innocent people being slaughtered by some, you know, regime is usually the word, you know, that's doing bad stuff.
That happens to always be socialist. Yeah, classic.
Right. And so the Korea was, you know, object lesson in that. And it was not called a war. It was called a police action. And then eventually everyone kind of admitted it was a war, but it was too late. It was already going on. So there was a mingling of the domestic politics and the international foreign policy, the foreign politics of the moment as well, because you had the Red Scare, the latest Red Scare, the McCarthyite Red Scare, cropping up right as the Korean War kicked off, and they fueled each other. So this is a meandering answer, but that's because it's a very important and I think just vast question. But, you know, what we're trying to do with the show is, of course, try to get it out there a little bit more. I think one more reason that also sort of addresses something I meant to say earlier about the flip side of the official history that we try to flesh out in the show is that, unlike Vietnam, which was viewed as a American openly imperial project in which we inherited it from the French and then we're just, you know, in another country for no good reason. That was the way it was perceived by, you know, many people. In Korea, again, the history was, well, those North Koreans did invade South Korea, right? You know, you're not supposed to do that. So it was viewed as, even when the war was unpopular, it was viewed as a just reason to intervene. Yeah. And what we try to do in the first several episodes of the show is take that apart a little bit, because I'm not convinced. Some would still try to argue, as the North, in fact, you know, officially says that they didn't, that the South was actually doing a large, a full scale invasion of the North. I don't think the evidence bears that out. There are certain skirmishes and battles that happened the day of that it is unclear who's starting what. But we know now from Soviet archives that Kim Il-sung had been planning to invade the South for many months. That's not really up for grabs as a theory anymore. However, he was doing that for several reasons that are not quote unquote unprovoked. The South was banging the war drum against the North for years. And in fact, most of the border incursions and fights, in which hundreds of troops were fighting and many people died, most of them were started by the South. So the South was maybe not waging a full-scale invasion yet, but it certainly wanted to. And defense ministers, Syngman Rhee himself, the president at the time, they were on record saying the only reason we haven't done it yet is because America tells us don't do it.
Yeah.
And so there was a war, there was a civil war brewing, and in fact, you could argue happening in the South, because another full episode we dedicate is to this uprising on Jeju Island, which is off of South Korea. It's a very independent, sort of autonomous island that was subject to the most brutal slaughter because it was left wing in the eyes of the South Korean government and the approving American military government as well. And that was a war. They killed 60,000 people, and then it spread to the mainland, and all totaled, it was probably around 100,000 people died in the South before the quote unquote Korean War ever happened. So does that make sense? You know, before the Korean War ever happened, there were 100,000 people dead. That starts to, if you know what I mean, sort of disintegrate this idea that it began on June 1950. I guess what I'm saying there is that the nice, tidy, clean reason for war was another reason why Korea was kind of looked at as this, as not the same thing as Vietnam, not as grotesque, not as unjustified, etc. In fact, what we try to do in the show is show how, apart from being a Soviet sneak attack, because Kim Il-sung did not take orders from Joseph Stalin, that's also on the record now. It was really a civil war between Koreans that, if it had been allowed to end in 1950, certainly some people would have died, probably thousands would have died. But I mean, I don't think anyone in the history says millions would have died. Yeah. It would have been yet another civil conflict in one country, because that's the other thing. The 38th parallel was not a line between two countries.
Yeah.
This was a temporary line drawn by two American bureaucrats. One went on to, Dean Rusk went on to become a high official in the American government. This was not a border in that sense. And so neither the South nor the North viewed it as such. So as Bruce Cummings puts it, I cite Bruce Cummings a lot because he's just an incredible resource. We do cite other people in the show, but he puts things very clearly. The idea of Koreans invading Korea makes no sense. And anyway, that's another reason why I think it's obscured in the way that Vietnam is not.
So you talked a little bit about the kind of the birth of the Cold War there and the U.S. position in it. But what role did the Soviet Union and China play in this conflict? What was their reason for participating, both covertly and overtly, and how much did they really participate?
It's very interesting, and we go into this on the show. There is a lot of politicking and intrigue just on the communist side, because let's say there's three camps. You know, there's the North Koreans, the Chinese, and the Soviets. The North Koreans are obviously the most connected to the conflict. They're in it. They want to, at first, and they almost succeed, they want to tear down this regime in the South and unify Korea. That is Kim Il-sung's goal. And in fact, it was also Syngman Rhee's goal, his opposite number in the South. But Kim did it first. He invaded and was very close to achieving that goal. The U.S. forces and the South Korean, I mean, the South Korean army just melted. And the U.S. forces were pushed toward the very tip of the peninsula in Busan, south of the South. And it looked like the North was going to win, which is why America intervened, quote-unquote intervened, invaded.
Yeah.
And so once that was reversed by MacArthur's quite ingenious landing at Incheon, which is on the West Coast, where he got behind North Korean lines and began to really pincer them, things got rolled back. And then the North is looking for serious help from both China and the USSR. And Stalin, before Kim had invaded, had said, sure, go ahead if you want, but you're going to need Mao's approval as well. And Mao really was conflicted over it. He did not love the idea, but he also found it difficult. It should be said, and this is, I hate to think how relevant this might be in a couple hours, let alone a couple days. Yeah. Taiwan was Mao's main issue at this time. And Taiwan is starting to crop up again now. Pelosi was going to visit. I don't know if that's still going to happen.
Yeah.
It was one of the, I mean, a lot of China wasn't united, actually, by the time the People's Republic was proclaimed. About a third had yet to come under control. But once that had been resolved, Taiwan was the place that Chiang Kai-shek, the former dictator of the Republic of China, fled. And that was what Taiwan became as a political entity, was this rump Republic of China government by this disgraced Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. So Mao was really just obsessed with making sure that Taiwan was brought into the political control of the new legitimate government of China. And that was what was on his mind. Korea was really not so pressing to him from a national interest point of view.
He had other shit to worry about, yeah.
He had a lot on his plate. And he was worried that this would kick off something that, you know, would get messy. However, he couldn't very well say, this is one reason, not the only reason, but he couldn't very well say to this fellow communist government, yeah, I know I just finished my civil war that united my country, but you shouldn't try to do the same. It wouldn't sound so good. And indeed, there was a real, you know, revolutionary solidarity between the two countries, because eventually, I think out of both a national security approach, but also out of a, you know, ideological and solidarity approach, China then sent quote-unquote volunteers to fight in Korea on behalf of the North. And that was when the United States was then pushed back again, almost to where it had been pushed back by the North Koreans initially. So China went in with both feet, as Truman once put it, because the Americans, particularly the MacArthur faction, were driving up to China's border. And China knew that the Americans were not happy with their revolution and that MacArthur was the type of psycho who might very well start World War III. And he had indeed, much to Truman's chagrin, already flirted with bombing and raids and troop movements toward China. So it was getting really dicey. And so the Chinese said, not only are they our comrades, we're probably next on the list.
Yeah.
And so they intervened. Now, Stalin was still alive at this point, and he died shortly after. Well, he died in 1953, so as the war was winding down. But in the earlier days, he was still very sharp, and he really wanted nothing to do with it. It's ironic that this is, in many, I suppose, textbooks or older histories or official American histories, it's called basically like Stalin's War. He really did not want to commit, so much so that he reneged on a promise to supply Mao air support and even, you know, certainly not troops. No Soviet troop fought in Korea. So you have this spectrum where, and we go into this intrigue on the show, it's very fun, but you have this spectrum where the North Koreans are obviously in the front lines, literally.
joined eventually by the Chinese out of probably both practical and ideological reasons, and then least involved, although very diplomatically on the side of the North Koreans and pushing for peace, was the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that's very interesting and runs completely counter to what, you know, you'll be told in the United States was how the war was run.
Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about dehumanization. We talk about Orientalism a lot here on the show, how it's used, by whom, and all that.
Are you pro or anti?
Are we pro or anti?
I'm just kidding.
We love Orientalism. It's like my favorite thing.
Okay, good. Yeah, yeah.
That's why we got like an Iraqi like just in the show just to sit around.
Just to cover our ass. Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
He's a good one. You know, he's a good Oriental.
Yes.
So give us your thoughts on how the State Department motivated the troops to commit to this absolutely barbaric destruction overseas.
It's funny, I was thinking about adding to my last answer something that'll fit right in here, which is I saw a lot of cartoons. We looked at like political cartoons or, you know, like contemporary cartoons from the time trying to propagandize the war or whatever. Mm. And one really common trope was that Stalin was the head of the communist side, that he was ordering everything, and that Mao was his lackey. There's all these cartoons where Mao is kind of like bowing to Stalin or puppeteered by Stalin, and was this kind of submissive, you know, Chinese sort of consigliere or whatever. And well, I'm mixing my national terms now, but you know what I mean? And that was, I think, served a lot of different purposes. You know, in America, it presented the Soviet Union as the undisputed head of world communism and obviously showed them as not different countries with, as we've just discussed, some different interests and different specific goals and even disagreements. I mean, we know the Sino-Soviet split would happen years later. But also, I think it was also aimed at international audiences, because I'm sure these types of images were circulated within China, which, again, had not fully wrested control from the nationalists, even when it was proclaimed, the PRC was proclaimed. One of the reasons they were so spooked in China, the leadership, was that there were rumors, not even factual events, but rumors that things were actually already falling apart and that invading armies were coming from the West, or the Chiang Kai-shek was sailing heroically back to China, and that was really destabilizing. And so these cartoons showing Mao as a lackey, I think they were also meant to insult the pride of Chinese people, thinking, you know, yeah, who is Mao to be taking orders from Stalin? You know, kind of like how British people were disgusted with Tony Blair being Bush's lapdog, you know what I mean?
Right.
And so it was a propaganda move showing the submissive Asian man bowing to the strong Russian, you know, chauvinist or whatever. Anyway, that's sort of a more of a little oddity. But the way that American GIs spoke about Koreans was very well captured in one of the completely forgotten books or, you know, pieces of reporting from the era called Cry Korea. It's a great book. I don't know how in print it is, but I have an older copy by a guy named Reginald Thompson. He was a British reporter. And the British, you know, once they lost their empire, some of them got really good at diagnosing it in others. And he was one of those very clear-eyed reporters from the time. He had great observations about MacArthur, great observations about the bizarre nature of the American war on Korea. And he was on the front lines, and he said that the American troops, while very friendly and very nice in other contexts, they didn't speak about Koreans as if they were human beings. He said they spoke about them like they were monkeys or apes, and that there were no... and of course, I mean, I don't know if you want, you can bleep it or whatever, but the slur gook was fully in use in Korea. And I believe it originated, it's an interesting thing, you can trace American empire actually with that word, because I believe it began in the Philippines, which is one of the earliest American imperial holdings, you know, in the 19th century. It follows MacArthur's dad and MacArthur from the Philippines, where MacArthur spent time as a young boy, into the Pacific theater of World War II, where it was used against the Japanese enemy. And then once again, it follows MacArthur into Korea. And you know, obviously the whole purpose of the slur and any slur is that they're all the same, even though these are different nationalities. Yeah. And you know, it was gook this and gook that. And that was obviously, like any slur, it was an easy way for troops to begin to synthesize the idea that these were animals who needed to be domesticated with their everyday speech and their everyday thoughts. And, you know, I mean, where to even begin about the propaganda and what the troops were told? But the generals and colonels, they were incredibly dismissive of the Korean military in the early days of the war. Not so much after they got their asses kicked a month in. Huh.
Also about the South Korean military as well. Were they like, okay, you know, we have to work with these guys, but as long as they follow our orders, things are going to happen. But
sure,
if
I mean,
let them run they're idiots.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting, I mean, the South Korean military, up until the war, I mentioned earlier, they completely melted away because mm-hmm. this was not a government. Unlike the North, this was not a government that many people supported in the South. That's why Kim thought he could do this. And, you know, even they're hardly dyed-in-the-wool Reds, you know, writing about this war, who were saying, like, yeah, this government was a cruel joke on the South Korea. And the reason most people didn't flee, and don't get me wrong, there were refugees. People fled when the North invaded, but the majority did not flee their homes. And someone observed, you know, maybe they would have if they liked Syngman Rhee or they liked the government they were under, but they didn't. So they stayed put. And then, of course, other people cheered that the North was trying to unify the country. And in fact, most people in the South wanted unification. Maybe not all of them wanted it from an invasion from the North, but they wanted Korea to be one again. Anyway, the South Korean military, the team we picked to support, was, as we've already discussed, by far a greater purveyor of violence both before and during the war. Extrajudicial executions, massacres. It's not that the North never got caught doing stuff like that, but it was disproportionately the South. That's just a matter of record. And it was very, you know, sometimes American troops were horrified by what the South Korean military was doing. It was sort of the least flattering portrayal of a military in that they ran when there was a war on, but when there were executions or people to, you know, put into ditches, they were all ready to go. You know, that was the team we were happy to work with while we occupied and then handed it off to the South Korean government. But I'm sure the Americans thought of them as savages as well. You know, I mean, they were looking at a lot of pretty gruesome stuff happening.
But like our savages, but, the ones that
but
are
they were our
in the
savages.
Process of domestication, yeah.
And then when they all fled, when the North invaded, the complaint was, why are our Koreans so cowardly? I think that was how, you know, one of them put it. So yes, there's this paternalistic instinct, no doubt. But also higher up on the chain, the American military was incredibly dismissive of both the North Korean and the Chinese militaries. And then they paid the price because... As I mentioned earlier, this was a war that up until the, you know, mid 1951, there were immense, it was like a pendulum swing back and forth where the North pushes almost all the way to the tip of the South. And then itself is pushed all the way up toward China by the Americans. And then when China enters the war, the Americans are pushed right back down the peninsula again. And then when they start to get wise to the guerrilla tactics of the Chinese and the North Koreans, they start to fight more cleverly, and they push them right back up again. So it was a very, very, you know, interesting military back and forth. But I guess that's all to say that, yes, there was a complete underestimation of the other side that was part and parcel of the official racism of the day. And a lot of talk of hordes.
Classic.
A lot of talk of Asian hordes, like Mordor style troops, which is ironic because a lot of the times there were no hordes.
Yeah.
The MacArthur did this very interesting thing where when the war was going well, he would exaggerate doom and gloom because he wanted to push on further, and he wanted audiences at home and perhaps even politicians in charge to feel like, yeah, you think it's going well, but we need to push even harder now because it's about to get worse.
Yeah.
Or when things were, of course, going badly for him, he pretended nothing was going amiss at all. He would exaggerate in either direction in order to push things further.
Good poker player, yeah.
Yeah. And so these hordes were in press releases and in statements, and then reporters on the ground would go, where are the Chinese hordes? We don't see anybody. And in fact, despite what people wrote or propagandized at the time, there were the UN forces and the Chinese and North Korean forces were equally matched by as far as numbers. There was no massive like dwarfing of the American or UN forces by Chinese volunteers. They were about the same number of people. There was also at the time, you know, domestically, there was the hunt for communism going on, and anyone who was advocating for civil rights or, you know, racial equality or any other number of things were called communists. Now, of course, many of the most active people organizing for racial justice were communists, but many were not as well. And it was, but you were called that no matter what. Hanson Baldwin was the New York Times military editor, and he wasn't a terrible analyst as far as the military stuff went. But I'll give you a quote here where he paints North Koreans not only as Mongol armies, like Genghis Khan style, but also as kind of successors to Hitler as well, which is an interesting combo. He said, he wrote, quote, "We are facing an army of barbarians in Korea, but they are barbarians as trained, as relentless, as reckless of life, and as skilled in the tactics of the kind of war they fight as the hordes of Genghis Khan. They have taken a leaf from the Nazi book of Blitzkrieg and are employing all the weapons of fear and terror." And elsewhere, this same New York Times editor wrote, "Behind the Korean stands the hordes of Asia. Ahead of him lies the hope of loot." So really just every trick in the bag there.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're Genghis Khan, they're Nazis, they're barbarians, but they're really smart and skilled. And all they care about is loot.
But it's kind of original for the time, right? Because now, you know, we're not going to get into the war in Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. But they're literally copying from the book of depicting Koreans and the Chinese in this specific way. The way they're depicting, you know, Ukrainians in one specific way and the Russian hordes in a different one. Not calling
sure.
one
the
side
orcs.
Good or bad. But yeah. Exactly, literally the orcs. But they are coming for the loot. Their mind does not work the same way as your European Western mind.
Absolutely.
Ukraine is right in the middle, and we can, domesticate them, what we were talking about previously. Well, the ones too far to the east are no longer domesticatable because, you know, too long, too much of time has passed, and they are whatever they are, which is literally what Nazis said for Slavs being influenced by the Judeo-Bolsheviks, etc. Sorry, I'm going on the rant, but it's beautiful how like it's very recycled, you know. So you, the Nazis, obviously they recycled. We all know this from monarchic approach and some pre like young fascist movements before that as well. But but at least they had like some originality in their batshit racism and quasi science. After that, we're refiltering the same shit.
It's funny the Nazis are even a factor in this comparison, because it's actually, funnily enough, one of the lawyers at the Nuremberg trials. We quote him in an episode. He was an American. I think his name was Telford Taylor, which is one of those old timey names that you don't see anymore. He said, quote, "Individual lives are not valued so highly in Eastern mores, and it is totally unrealistic of us. It's unrealistic of us to expect the individual Korean soldier to follow our most elevated precepts of warfare." So, yeah, I mean, you got everything here. You've got the paternalism. You've got the barbarian angle. You've got the, you know, uncivilized looting angle. But they're also hyper-industrialized like the Nazis, I guess. And so then when things started to turn around, here's an Associated Press headline from the time, quote, "G.I. Joe decides the gooks are pretty good fighting men."
Jesus.
So, you know, like, surprise, surprise, you know. And one of the historians, you know, as well, that we interviewed noted that it seemed to surprise Americans that the North Koreans, when pressed on their anti-imperialism, actually were really actually willing to fight about it. You know, they weren't just mouthing off. It was sort of like, for some reason that was not anticipated, but you know, the Koreans put their money where their mouth was, and it caught everybody off guard.
It just goes to show that kind of terminology and that propagandizing of your own troops can kind of backfire, because it makes them willing to commit these atrocities, but it also makes them complacent and thinking, oh, these people aren't, you know, they're not smart like we are. We're gonna steamroll them. But no, sure enough, they're just as dedicated, if not more so, to fend off these invaders.
Yeah, that's I don't know if everyone in the military at that level was underestimating them, but I mean, I definitely there were there were serious consequences to underestimating them and to, of course, thinking of them as subhuman, that they wouldn't be able to fight back effectively. I mean, these guys, you know, particularly in the North, Kim Il-sung was beloved in North Korea because he was a guerrilla fighter against the Japanese. I mean, he certainly lived a very charmed life once he became president. But I mean, the guy was in the worst of the worst of it in Manchuria when he was fighting the Japanese invaders in what was then Manchukuo with the Chinese communists. The shock troops of the North in 1950 were those guys who were still coming back from Manchuria with the winding down of the Chinese Civil War. So these guys had been through the shit, and the Americans were largely, you know, kind of gee whiz, sort of untested kids who were hanging out in Japan up until that point, you know? And so they got their asses handed them.
Well, I think this is the end of our official questions, but just out of curiosity, like one thing that comes to mind is the modern day DPRK. Obviously the propaganda has continued throughout the years and it's still cast as, you know, the worst place on earth and stuff like that. But in researching for this season three, did you draw any conclusions about modern day North Korea? Do you think that the average American has consumed a little too much propaganda and that maybe a bit more nuance is in order?
Yes, our final episode of the season does move into the more contemporary era. We kind of try to do a speed run, as we often do, of the years since the conflict that takes up most of the season. And the whole point of the show is that there's many conclusions to draw from how this war. I won't go on too long, but listeners to even this conversation we're having can probably guess that the effect of being holocausted by the U.S. military will decide a lot about your society for the subsequent decades. And the North definitely became, in a sense, a sort of garrison state. It was it became a highly militarized society. There are some interesting overlaps, honestly. Again, I don't want to get in trouble here. I'm not talking about every parallel at all, but there are some interesting overlaps between Israel and North Korea. I'll say that in very specific ways, but not across the board. But it is a highly militarized society. For a while, it was quite a dynamic economy. People might be surprised nowadays to hear that, but it was for the rest of the 20th century, it was really the North that was industrializing effectively and creating better lives for its people. And it was the North Koreans that were sending food aid to the South in the 70s and 80s. Mm. And then the 90s completely turned everything around because the South began to find its legs as a powerhouse hyper-capitalist economy that found its way into the global marketplace, and the North got hit with several famines and several floods and a drought that caused horrible famines and was at that point completely isolated by the United States from getting a lot of aid to help them escape that. There was also mismanagement as well.
But also lost its largest trading partners across the board.
And needless to say, the Soviet Union,
70 to 80% of the trade was cut off overnight. So that might have a little bit of an effect.
much like Cuba, as we discussed in our last season.
In a special period,
So what's interesting, though, is that the nuclear issue is how people... There's two ways that we propagandize about the North Koreans. One is through human rights, and one is through the nuclear issue.
Yeah.
I think there's plenty of things you can argue about with regard to the North's political practice. I think a lot of it is explainable, which isn't to say desirable, but it is very much exaggerated. I mean, there's a show in South Korea called On My Way to See You that is effectively a kind of weird mixture of a beauty pageant and a kind of Oprah show where defectors, quote unquote, defectors from the North, some of them have been tricked into defecting. Mm. There's an interesting little documentary called Loyal Citizens of Pyongyang
that I saw
that gives you clips from this show. I'm not saying every defector was tricked, but there's evidence. There's South Korean lawyers who represent people who were. And the stuff that is cooked up about the North is just, I mean, I play a little montage in the first episode of this season, you know, trying to give an idea of just how wild these stories are.
Yeah.
It was really good right at the beginning.
It's really, really good.
Thanks. There's an NBC segment where this woman is like listing all the horrible things about North Korea, and among them are murder and rape. And it's just like, unlike most countries, there's crime.
I have to interrupt you. I love it. There was, I don't know what the news anchor was doing it, but they were like, in North Korea, they discriminate against you and put you into groups based on gender, yep. based on this, that, yeah. that. And then she says, and they call it class, and they oppress you based on this class that you belong to. It was just, I love it.
Yep.
I love it.
She says they divide the population into a class system.
Oh, yes. They do. Yeah.
That sounds horrible.
I would hate that.
So anyway, I mean, and again, I'm not trying to be glib. But the thing is that it's really, I mean, the South did all that shit too. It's weird that the South had labor camps and concentration camps all of its own. And the nuclear point is, I think, really what they really go for. The human rights stuff is always the kind of dressing on the side. It's the nuclear stuff, just like Iraq, you know, was supposed to be, yeah, he's a dictator, he's blah blah blah, but you should really be scared about the nuke he has.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting there is that the United States introduced nukes into the Korean Peninsula way back in the 50s. The first nuclear weapons to arrive there were courtesy of the US of A in South Korea, obviously. And we kept them there for decades. We pulled them out once smart bombs started to become a more palatable way to imagine, you know, keeping them under control. But nukes were there for a long time. It wasn't the North that introduced nukes to the peninsula. And in fact, the South, much to the chagrin of the United States, when it learned that the nukes were going to go away, they wanted to develop their own clandestine secret nuclear program. Mm. The North at this point had not even begun to start its own clandestine nuclear program. It was the last person out of the U.S. and the South and the North. The North was the last party to start developing possible nukes. So that was in the late 80s. They were developing nuclear power because, like Japan and South Korea, it was an alternative energy source that they wanted to use to meet their energy needs. But they probably knew at that point that they had been staring down the nuclear, you know, barrel of a gun, that they would probably be comfortable knowing it could be used for a weapons program as well, but they weren't necessarily driving for that. And then in the 90s, they absolutely said, yeah, we got to make sure we have a guarantee, you know? Yeah. And so it's interesting actually how long it took them to really start to consider the nuclear deterrent. It was way after the US and South Korea. So for anyone interested in hearing the show, yeah, in episode 10, we do go into, the back and forth of most recent American administrations, you know, from Clinton to Trump, because it's very interesting to see the different approaches taken, although all of them, you know, needless to say, agree on sanctions and isolation of North Korea. There was almost a breakthrough in the Clinton years, which is interesting. And then the Bush people arrived and it was DOA. So missed opportunity there.
Well, this has all been super fascinating, and I think we're all agreed that we're all going to go listen to season 3 immediately after this. So, Brendan, thank you so much for coming on. Can you tell our listeners where they can find you and your content?
Sure. Blowback season 3 is now available on www.blowback.show. You just go to our website and hit the big button that says subscribe. Just pop in your payment information. It's one-time payment. It's $25. And you'll get the entire season and 10 bonus episodes and some other goodies as well. I'm not really on Twitter that much, but if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm @deep_beige. I'm going to be rolling out, you know, the show as we launch it here from that account. You can also follow Blowback at @blowbackpod. On Twitter.
Awesome. All right. Well, you heard the man. Everybody go listen to Blowback. If you don't, Ugopnik will personally hunt you down.
I will. All the links are going to be in the description, be it if you're watching this as a video or on any of the audio platforms. So Yeah, what JT said. I will find you, and I will. You know that meme where when the guy tries to sound like fucking Liam Neeson, and then he listens back, and it's like, I will find you. I will, so I'm not even going to attempt this. But I will Liam Neeson, you motherfucker. So, yes.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening. This has been The Deprogram. I'm JT.
I'm Hakeem, and I haven't contributed anything.
I'm Yugopnik.
I'm Brendan.
All right, guys. We'll see you next time.